I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. The Soviet Ambassador is a terrific book that's out now. Joining me now is its author, Christopher Shulgin. It is a well-written and fascinating account of the life of Alexander Yakovlev, who we learn played an important and vital role in the run-up to the end of the Cold War. An advisor to Mikhail Gorbachev, he is considered the architect of perestroika and the godfather of glasnost. The book also highlights the role Canada played in shaping Yakovlev's beliefs, as well as how it helped form the friendship between him and Gorbachev. Christopher Shulgin won a National Magazine Award last year. He contributes to the Globe and Mail and Maclean's, and most recently was a writer-at-large at Toro. His website is shulgin.com. The Soviet Ambassador, The Making of the Radical Behind Perestroika, is published by McClelland and Stewart and retails for $34.99. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Christopher Shulgin. Good morning, Mr. Shulgin.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
When did you first hear of or learn about Alexander Yakovlev?
Well, I've been a buff of Cold War history for as long as I can remember. I'm a member of the last generation that grew up during the Cold War, and I can remember in the 80s, in retrospect, when Reagan was doing his most vociferous saber-rattling. I think that's a mixed metaphor, but I'm going to keep going.
Right.
But when he was really ratcheting up the rhetoric in the Cold War, say 1983, 1984, I can remember feeling concerned and aware that if the Cold War ever actually did go hot, if a nuclear war happened, that me and my family and everyone around me would probably die. And it was a tremendously, as a young teenager, it was a tremendously disconcerting thing. So I was always fascinated with the Cold War. And in the early 90s, I was reading David Remnick's book, Lenin's Tomb, which chronicles the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, I mean, this is a book about Moscow, and it's a book about Mikhail Gorbachev and the people around him, one of whom is a figure named Alexander Yakovlev. And as Remnick is describing Alexander Yakovlev's life, which is a remarkably fascinating life, Remnick does it in about 10 pages, but it's obvious that Remnick would love to have spent more time on Yakovlev. And one of the really key moments that Remnick talks about in Yakovlev's life is this moment that happened in Canada, which I learned that, and that sort of threw me, what is this happening in Canada? And then not only did it happen in Canada, it happened in the county where I grew up. And the moment that I'm talking about is Yakovlev has this penultimate conversation with Mikhail Gorbachev, where the two of them, for the first time, speak honestly about the problems confronting the Soviet Union. And knowing that this happened in my backyard just drew me to the subject all the more. And from then, I just started looking into Yakovlev's life, which turns out to be a fascinating story.
I don't know where it is in the book, but you talk about Yakovlev walking around while he was in Canada with his young granddaughter.
Yes, yes.
Did you ever see that?
Did I ever see the two of them walking around?
Yourself, or did you hear about that later on?
Well, I mean, I did. Yakovlev's granddaughter was a huge help in the research for the book. So she is the one who told me about that. And then the two of them were a much discussed couple in Ottawa in the 70s and early 80s. Because imagine this. Imagine in Canada, in Ottawa in the 70s and early 80s, when you have this boogaboo, this big scary country, the Soviet Union, the world's largest country that can wipe North America off the face of the earth with nuclear missiles. And its principal emissary is this kindly older gentleman who is best known for walking through Rockcliffe Park, limping through Rockcliffe Park because his knee was fused, his left knee was fused, with this beautiful little blue-eyed, blonde-haired girl. It was such an incongruous image that a lot of people in Ottawa talked about it at the time.
Remnick called Yakovlev Gorbachev's good angel. What was his role at the time? Like, did he have a formal title? Was he an advisor to Gorbachev?
He had several titles throughout Gorbachev's rule in the Soviet Union. He was the chief of propaganda. He was a member of the Politburo. At some points, he's just called a senior advisor. But all of these various hats, none of them individually conveys the extent of the importance that of Yakovlev's role in Gorbachev's inner circle. Gorbachev, as a politician, and as a somewhat indecisive politician, really relied on his advisors for policy, for policy ideas, and for strategy when policy overran itself. And in each aspect, in each major decision that happened in the Soviet Union in the period from 1985 to 1991, Yakovlev was the guy who was pulling hardest for democracy, for freedom, for capitalism. It's always, among all of these various disparate personalities, Shevardnadze, Khrushchev, the KGB chief, all of the guys at the top, Yakovlev is pulling the whole bunch toward the West and toward freedom and democracy. And there's speculation that without Yakovlev there, that the reforms that happened in the Soviet Union in that period would have gone very differently.
There was speculation that he was a spy for the CIA.
Which, I mean, isn't that fascinating? And not only is there speculation that he was a spy for the CIA, but the guy doing the speculation is the chief of the KGB. And if there isn't a more telling description of Yakovlev's importance within Gorbachev's inner circle, I'm not sure what it could possibly be. You know, when the guy who is to use a bit of slang, when the guy dissing you is the chief of the KGB, maybe the most evil guy in the Soviet Union, you know you're pretty good, and you not only know you're pretty good, you know you're doing some pretty good stuff.
So how did Yakovlev evolve? He was a Stalin. You write in the book he was a Stalin acolyte who became Stalinism's nemesis.
That's right. So it's a long that's the story of the book. The book is the story of Yakovlev's evolution, and he evolved slowly, beginning in a period in the Second World War when he fought. And I go into detail about the battles in which he fought in the Second World War. All the way up to the time that he was in Canada. Canada's significance there is interesting because in the late 60s, Yakovlev has these suspicions he's certain that the system, that the Soviet system in communism isn't working the way it should. He doesn't know what to do about it. He has some suspicions that perhaps it would be good to move toward democracy. He's not sure. He hasn't really seen democracy in action. What happens is that he ends up in Canada through very random circumstances. By the end of his 10 years in Canada, he is absolutely convinced that democracy is the way to go. So what I like to say is that the Canada evolved his suspicions into conviction.
He came to Canada as a Soviet ambassador because he had a falling out with the leadership in the Kremlin at the time. That's right.
Correct, yeah.
Well, when he came to Canada, what did he learn about what did he learn that he liked about this country? I mean, one of the interesting things about reading the book is and I'm not much younger than you are, and one of the interesting things is seeing how the world is so much different from today. And how Canada is different from today.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one thing that we forget, we're coming up on 20 years since the Cold War. I mean, the Cold War really ended when the Eastern European republics toppled in late autumn of 1989. And one thing that we forget about the Cold War is the way that the world was polarized. And it was polarized between Soviet communism on one hand and American democracy on the other hand. What happens in 1973 when Yakovlev ends up in Canada as the Soviet ambassador to Canada is that he learns that America doesn't have a monopoly on democracy. He learns that a country can be democratic without necessarily being American. At the time, in 1973, there was this wave of resurgent nationalism in Canada, and there was pride. Canada was suddenly discovering that perhaps it was a better country to live in than the United States. And what happens is that Yakovlev gets caught up in this. You know, he starts to admire Canada. And he learns from Canada's example that perhaps democracy is the best way to go.
Who did he meet first, Eugene Whelan or Pierre Trudeau?
No, Whelan is actually quite late in Yakovlev's time in Canada. Whelan comes around 1978. The first major figure within the Canadian government with whom he develops a close friendship is a man named Ivan Head. Ivan Head was sort of the Kissinger of Ottawa. So Kissinger, Henry Kissinger for Nixon, was going around the world meeting with various leaders and really leading a jet set lifestyle. Trudeau was positioning Ivan Head in a very similar manner.
And there, when they met, when Head met with Yakovlev, did they strike up an immediate friendship?
Virtually. There was a meeting. Head would have had to have met Yakovlev in a formal capacity when Yakovlev was formally installed by the Canadian government as the Soviet ambassador to Canada. That's a very cursory meeting. What happens very shortly after is that Yakovlev telephones Ivan Head and invites him to come over to the Soviet ambassador's residence for an informal meeting. And it's during that meeting that Ivan Head decides that he likes this figure, this Ambassador Yakovlev.
And he introduces him to Trudeau immediately?
Yeah, very soon after he introduces him to Trudeau, and Trudeau, who has always been fascinated with the Soviet Union, Trudeau very quickly befriends Yakovlev, and you know, in a very interesting way, the two men develop this this intense relationship where they would get together and debate issues. I mean, it's a fascinating process.
Before reading the book, you had a piece in The Walrus about Yakovlev coming to British Columbia.
That's right.
And when was that?
When did he go to British Columbia?
Yeah, when did he go to the Doukhobor place?
May of 1980.
And what did he learn there that sort of, I guess, did it inspire him?
Oh, certainly. It very much inspired him. What happens in the Russian mindset is that there's this thing called Russian exceptionalism. And that's the idea that Russians are different, that Russians, in contrast to people in the West, have some character traits that makes democracy a tough go in the Soviet Union years ago and now in Russia. The idea is that Russians are so connected to the land and that Russia is such a big and complex society that it can't be ruled by something as unstable as democracy, which is nonsense. And what happens is that Yakovlev goes to, at a very dark time, immediately after the Soviet Union has invaded Afghanistan, Yakovlev goes to British Columbia at the invitation of the community of Doukhobors, who live in southeastern British Columbia, in the Kootenays, and he sees these people who are very Russian, who have held on to their Russian traditions and Russian heritage, and he learns that they are thriving under democracy and that they themselves are more Russian perhaps than even some of the citified, the urbanized Russians back in the Soviet Union. And at the same time, they're thriving in this system of democracy and freedom. And what it does is disputes Russian exceptionalism to Yakovlev.
George Cohen, the McDonald's guy.
Yes.
How did he meet Yakovlev?
Cohen, in a very Cohen-esque sort of manner, just calls up Yakovlev in 1976, after the 1976 Olympics in Montreal. What happens is that the next Olympics, the next Summer Games, are going to be in Ottawa, and Cohen has this idea...
In Russia.
That's right. The next Summer Games are going to be in Russia, and Kohan has this idea that he wants to open the first McDonald's at the Olympic Games behind the Iron Curtain in Russia. So if you're a Canadian and you want to do this, the first person whom you call is the Soviet ambassador to Canada. And unusually, I mean, you would think that the Soviet ambassador to Canada would have told Kohan that he's crazy. I mean, McDonald's is the epitome of capitalism, and it could have been quite a scandalous thing for McDonald's to open up in Russia in 1980, particularly in 1980. In fact, what happens is that Yakovlev says, well, I will help you. I believe, by this point, he's spent 3 years in Canada, and he becomes and befriends George Kohan.
He liked McDonald's, Yakovlev?
Yeah, he liked... You know, I don't know... I actually have never asked Kohan this, whether he was whether he loved the Big Mac. But he liked the...
The idea of getting the food to the masses, I think, was what I read in your book.
Well, yeah, and he liked the effect that McDonald's could have on the Soviet Union. Both Kohan and Yakovlev suspected that if McDonald's opened up in Moscow, that it could have this transformative effect on the Russian economy when people would see how much better the McDonald's service is than the service that happened in Soviet restaurants. And they would start thinking, in the same way that Yakovlev did, that capitalism wasn't such a bad thing.
You interviewed Yakovlev in 03.
That's right.
What was that for?
It was for a story in Saturday Night Magazine about the 20th anniversary of the May 1983 trip that Gorbachev made across Canada.
What was he like in person?
Who's that, Yakovlev?
Yeah.
Well, bear in mind that at that point I was in Canada. I did that through email. So I sent him a list of questions, and then he sent them back to me. I didn't meet him. I never met Alexander Yakovlev. But in terms of what he was like as a person, I mean, if you spend 2.5 years researching every aspect of a man's life, you get an idea of what he was like as a person. And he was a warm, and quite a kind person with a subversive sense of humor, who could really, in a tense moment, would have a subversive aside that would defuse the tension. What's interesting about Yakovlev, though, is that he was very fervent in his belief. So when he believed in communism, he very fervently believed in communism. And then when he turned around and changed his mind and became an enthusiast for democracy, he very fervently and enthusiastically believed in democracy.
He was the only one present in the meetings between Gorbachev and Yeltsin when they were negotiating the transfer of power.
That's right.
What do we learn from him being there that we haven't learned already, if anything?
Well, we learn. To me, that's a testament to Yakovlev's role in Russia's fascinating history, Russia's ever fascinating history. What a figure, and what a metaphor for his role. What this is, to describe the situation, Gorbachev is negotiating his final transfer of power to Yeltsin. So this is a transfer of power from the Soviet Union to the country of Russia. And as an intermediary there, neither of these guys liked each other. Gorbachev despised Yeltsin, and by this time, Yeltsin despised Gorbachev. Yakovlev is there because he knew both men, and both men, he got along with both men. And it's interesting metaphorically because intermediary in history between Gorbachev and Yeltsin. It's fascinating.
You mentioned Russian exceptionalism earlier.
Yes.
And I think in thinking about how different the world is from then and how different it is from today, both in Canada and in Russia and around the world, do you think there are lessons here that we can learn about how to deal with the current regime that's there?
Oh, absolutely. I think You know, the tendency is to look at the current move away from democracy that's occurring in Russia and to say that, well, Perestroika was this anomaly and it doesn't matter. It was unimportant because its effects are being erased. In fact, I would argue that Perestroika is more important because what it becomes is a case study of the rare time that Russia moved toward democracy. And what we have to look into is the reasons that Russia moved toward democracy in the Perestroika period. And a heck of a lot of the reasons have to do with Alexander Yakovlev and his life story. I mean, there are tremendously important extenuating factors. The Soviet economy was in shambles, and meanwhile Ronald Reagan is spending the heck out of the American economy to build up the arms race. But at its root, Yakovlev and Gorbachev, the Kremlin could have proceeded for several years just running things the way it did, or they could have reformed things in a profoundly different manner. They could have clamped down on Russian society, as some were saying, and made it even more of a police state and tried to winnow out the corruption that way. So it didn't have to happen the way it did. The reason that it happened the way it did is Alexander Yakovlev. And to me, what's important about that is that he, you know, let's look at his evolution and let's look at what made him into this democratically minded insider in order to learn how we should deal with today's Russia, or for that matter, other totalitarian societies such as the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, or the junta in Myanmar. I mean, you know, perhaps we can see these other totalitarian societies with little Yakovlev.
You're trying to put up a plaque. I guess that's in Windsor, is it?
That's correct. Yes.
Is this on the Wayland property?
On his front lawn, yes.
And that's where the friendship between, or the I guess you call it the conversation between Gorbachev and Yakovlev takes place.
That's right.
How are you going with that? You're accepting, I guess, signatures on your site, right?
Well, it's on an online petition. It's going very well. You know, the book's only been out a couple of days, so it's still early days yet. At the end of the day, I'm trying to demonstrate that there is a groundswell of support to the Ontario Heritage Trust, which is the provincial organization that creates these historical plaques in Ontario. And I'm trying to demonstrate to them that there is a support for this plaque. The Ontario Heritage Trust doesn't dispute the significance of this meeting between Gorbachev and Yakovlev. They are a little uncomfortable with doing it, what they regard as so soon. It's only 25 years ago that this conversation happened, and they're saying that perhaps we should wait a little longer. Perhaps we should allow it to fade into history, to make it history a little more. I mean, my sense to that is that this is a story that needs telling, and it's a story that can have a profound effect on relations between countries that are disagreeing. More people should know this story.
Even though the book's just been out, as you said, a few days, a number of people have read the book. What was your reaction to some of the blurbs that you got, especially the one from Margaret Macmillan?
Oh, I mean, gosh, you spend 2 years of your life laboring in obscurity. I do most of my writing at the University of Toronto's big library, Robarts Library, on the 11th floor of the U of T library. And for 2 years, I would ride my bike to the library, and I would go up to the 11th floor and get into my study carrel, and I would write for, you know, 10 hours, and then I would get on my bike and ride home. And I didn't talk to anybody about the story, really. You know, I mean, I would talk to my wife or my close friends, but really, that's the only people who were hearing about my research. And then to finish the book, and then to have people who I admire so much, such as Margaret Macmillan, or the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer William Taubman, have such complimentary reactions to my book. I mean, it's just tremendously gratifying. When I heard that Margaret McMillan had blurbed the book, I put the phone down and basically ran around my house because I admire her so much, and it's helped the book a tremendous amount.
She seems. Have you ever met her?
No, I haven't. Although when Robarts Library was closed, or sometimes it gets too busy, I would go to Trinity College Library, which is another library in the University of Toronto system. And
right.
She was a very important part of Trinity College for a long time, and her book is everywhere in that library. So she was a very, and you know, I had read Paris 1919, which is a great narrative history, and I was trying to achieve that sort of page turning, but still historically accurate sort of form. And from McMillan's reaction, I achieved it, which is really nice.
Well, we had her on before for her Nixon book.
Okay.
And she just seems like a really nice lady, even though she's super smart and highly regarded, but she just seems someone that you can talk to, you know what I mean?
I would love to meet her, frankly. I mean, that would be a very... I mean, maybe I'd ask her for an autograph, I don't know.
What are you working on next, Chris?
I have a couple of... we're putting together proposals. My agents and I are putting together a proposal for the second book now. And it's a... there are two proposals that are going out. One is a narrative history, and then one is a memoir about fatherhood. A very different project. I became a father as I started writing this book, and it's about how becoming a father inspired me to sort of clean up my life and become a better person, which I think happens with a lot of people. It's kind of a universal story.
Well, congratulations on this book. I must say that Russian politics and Russian culture doesn't interest me all that much, but I found that I was quite fascinated and you couldn't put the book down, you know?
Oh, thanks so much. Thank you.
The book is called The Soviet Ambassador, The Making of the Radical Behind Perestroika, $34.99 from McClelland and Stuart. Shulgin.com is the website for the commentary. I'm Joseph Planta.